Let's walk back together 2,500 years to a city called Susa in what is now Iran. The year is 483 BC, and a young girl who's maybe not even yet in her teens. She's called Esther Hadassah, and she's playing on the street outside. She's eating her tea. She says goodnight to her uncle or guardian. And then she goes to bed and she lies in her bed and she wonders, what will my future hold? Will I get married? Will I matter? Will I make a difference? What has God got in store for me? This God that I've been told about, that I've been taught about, the God of my uncle, the God of my parents, the God of my people, the Jews, the God of Israel, the God of history, the God of Jacob, Isaac, Abraham. What has God got in store for me? And as she drifts off to sleep, that's what's in her mind. Across the city, a party is going on, a great banquet. And the greatest man in the known world, Xerxes, is holding court. He's thrown a party for all the men of the city. And he's half drunk. And he calls for his wife to be brought. His wife, who is beautiful beyond compare. And he says, bring her in here. Tell her to put a crown on. Let's all look and see. And she refuses. She won't come. And Xerxes is in now a great fury. And he promptly, publicly, loudly, widely gets rid of the queen from his presence, from her crown. These two events take place in the same city. One is imagined, but Esther would have been there somewhere, just a young girl. And it brings us to this great verse that many of us will know. And we know, for we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. One is an event of history. The other is a girl who is unknown, unrecognized. And yet, for Esther, wherever she was on that night, whatever she was doing, we find that God is working out things for her good in greater ways than she could possibly have imagined. We set out this evening on a 5-week journey through this book of Esther. And our guide through this book will be that verse from Romans 8. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, those who have been called according to his purpose. The book of Esther is a story of salvation. It's a story that's set in the throne room and at the banquet hall. And it's a story where God is not mentioned at all. Nowhere in these chapters does God get a mention. Is his name? Does anybody do anything in his name? God is, in some ways, at least on the paper, absent from the book of Esther. And yet what we'll see is God is working. God is at work in the strangest of circumstances, in the most unseen of ways. So we're going to walk through tonight. We'll look at the setting briefly, and then the story, and then two things for us to think on. Firstly, our God is not absent. And secondly, our King is better. So here's the setting. Look down again at Esther, the start of the chapter. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. Here is Xerxes. Xerxes is the emperor, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. And we know, don't we? We read Daniel not long ago on a Sunday evening. We know that God's people, who'd been given God's place, the promised land of Canaan, which had become Israel, his people had wandered far from him, had turned their back on God, had run after other gods, their own ways. And God had said to them from the beginning, if you do not follow me, then you will not get my benefits. You'll be out. Other kingdoms will come and they will rule and reign over you. And that is the history of God's people. As we arrive in Esther, that's what's happened. God's people have turned their back on God. And God has been merciful and patient. But eventually they went too far. Eventually there was a point of no return. And so God's people, the Jews, the nation of Judah, Israel first and then Judah, are taken over, are conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. You see it up there, 568 BC, Nebuchadnezzar sacks Jerusalem. And then Nebuchadnezzar is succeeded. But we don't read about Belshazzar, don't we, in Daniel. And we read of Cyrus, the Medo-Persian king who comes and conquers the great empire of Babylon. Another empire comes in with Cyrus. And then there's Darius. And then there's Xerxes. Xerxes is a title. It means king. It is utterly confusing trying to work out who in the Bible Xerxes is. I was chatting to some guys after lunch today. And just saying, it's confusing. Who is this man? There he is, 486. Xerxes comes to the throne of the Medo-Persian Empire. And we know from our history in Daniel that God has been at work in his people, through his people. And we know that God's plan for his people is not always for them to stay in exile. And so if we've read Ezra and Nehemiah, we've seen a group of people, God's people, going back to Jerusalem, going back to God's promised land. And as we arrive in Esther, we arrive at a point where some people have gone. If you read Ezra, we see how God intercedes, speaks to Cyrus, the great king. And Cyrus sends out this command that the Jewish people can go back and rebuild the temple. And so when we arrive in Esther, some have gone. Some of the rebuilding has begun. And yet some of God's people are still here. Still in Susa, still spread throughout the empire. So then the story. And the story is relayed in Esther 1, focuses on Xerxes. This man, this king. Okay, so you can see his empire. Sorry, we can go back to the map. Okay, this is his empire. Verse 1, we're told he rules over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. That area there surrounded by the red line. This massive, great empire. We're told about that. And then we're told, verse 4, about his wealth. He throws this banquet which lasts for half a year. Inviting people from all ends and either side of his empire. They all come. For a full 180 days he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom. And the splendor and glory of his majesty. Just imagine what that party was like. It's not one of those parties where it gets to 9 o'clock and you think, oh, well, I'm glad it's, you know, winding down now so I can go home and sleep. It's just day one. There's another half a year to go. And the food keeps coming. And the drink keeps coming. And new people keep arriving. And we read about Xerxes' generosity. Look down at verse 5. After that great banquet party ended, he throws another one. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who are in the citadel of Susa. The first party people come from everywhere. The great and the mighty. It's a party, a banquet designed to show off his wealth, his majesty, his glory. Look how great I am. And yet there seems to be some degree of thankfulness. He throws a smaller party, just a week this time, for all the people of his city. Not just for the great now, but for everybody. From the greatest to the least. For a whole week. And they all come in. And Xerxes says, oh, let the wine flow. Look down at verse 8. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink without restriction. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. It's open bar. Don't worry about what the king's doing. There's no rules here about sticking with the king's whatever he's drinking. No, just go for it. Just go for it. And then the king starts to drink. And he gets, well, verse 10, on the seventh day when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine. He's had a few. And he calls for his wife to be brought out. He commands the eunuchs. I'm not going to name them. To bring before him, verse 11, Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the peoples and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. The author of Esther doesn't tell us whether this is a good thing, a bad thing. He doesn't cast any aspersions on the king for doing this, although maybe we can read into it. It doesn't sound particularly pleasant. We're told there are two banquets going on, one for the men and one for the women. And she's called to come before the men's banquet so they can look. And maybe more. Verse 12, when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. How dare she? How dare she, in front of other people, how dare she turn me down? How dare she make me look weak? And no doubt the alcohol at this point is fueling this fury. He's not thinking straight. He's thinking without inhibition. And so he calls his experts in. These seven nobles who advise, who have access to the king. And he says, what shall I do? How do I respond to this? And one, Memucan, stands up and comes with his own motives. His own reason, says, there's no way you can let this stand. If the queen does this, well, then every other woman will do it too. Every other wife. We're all in trouble. You see what he says, the end of verse 18. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of the disrespect and discord. And we can laugh. But it's sad, isn't it? The Memucan says, you've got to stamp this out. You've got to get rid of her. Verse 19, therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of the Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Send it out to everybody. Let everybody know this is what you've decided. She's to be gone. You are done with her. And the king, verse 21, the king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. So the king did as Memucan proposed. And that's the story. And you'd be forgiven for getting to the end of that story and going, well, that's quite interesting, but so what? I say you could be forgiven for that because that's what I thought. I thought, okay, thanks for this, Simon. Because Esther 1 is a set-up chapter. It's given us the information that will help us understand what's going to happen in the chapters to come. So we hear about one queen in light of another queen that is to come. We hear about the king, how he deals with his wife. So that when his new wife comes before him, we're fearful. For her, for Esther, when she will come before the king. But I think Esther 1, as well as being a set-up chapter, also has a lot to say to us about the absence of God. The perceived absence of God. So we said at the start, because some of God's people have now left. They've gone home. They've gone back to Jerusalem. If we were to open our Bibles, Esther comes after Ezra and Nehemiah. Two stories about God's people returning to God's promised land. A land of blessing. A land that belongs to them. A land given to them by God where you would dwell with them. His presence with them in the temple. We know that the temple building project is already underway. All roads lead home. And the way that the Bible has been put together leads us to have our eyes looking to Jerusalem. And Esther 1 doesn't disabuse us of that notion. Because God's not here. And Esther's not even here. And Mordecai's not here. And the Jewish people are not here. It's as though the narrator of the story of Esther is going, yeah, look, I know everybody's looking that way. There's still some stuff going on over here, but it doesn't even seem that important. It doesn't seem that major. God's people have gone home, and God's obviously looking that way. And look, here's another king, and he's doing what he wants and does what he pleases. And if we can think that as we read our Bibles, how much more could Esther or Mordecai or any other Jew who had not gone, who had not returned to Jerusalem, how much more could they have been forgiven for thinking, God's looking somewhere else. God's not interested. We are forgotten. God's not here. And I think the author of Esther, and it might be Mordecai, he seems to want to make this point. We're not going to find God in Esther 1. We're not going to find God in the rest of Esther. Where is he? Is he preoccupied with the events in Jerusalem? Is God kind of like Sauron in Lord of the Rings? A great big eye on top of a tower who can only look in one place. And because he's looking over here, everything that's going on over here is undetected. Perhaps you know what that feels like. Perhaps you know what it's like because your school is like that. It's a place where God is not mentioned. It's where a place where God is not honored. It's a place where even when you study about God, the Bible is derided. Where the only time you hear God's name is when people are swearing. Maybe that's what your workplace is like. You go into work on a Monday morning and you're the only Christian there. You're the only person who, it seems, has got any concern for justice or for righteousness or for the truth. Perhaps this is what your home feels like. That your home life, your family life couldn't feel any further removed from this, from the gathered people of God joining together to worship because your husband or your wife doesn't believe. Or your children have rejected what they were taught. That you think to go home is to a place where to even mention God or the hope of the gospel seems almost inappropriate. Those thoughts that form in your head and get to your mouth, those thoughts die on your tongue when you want to speak of Jesus. And you think, God's looking somewhere else. Is God even here? In all of those situations, it's tempting to ask, well, where is God? Does God see me and my circumstances? And from there, it's the shortest of steps to ask him, well, does God even care? Esther chapter 1 tells us that God does see. God puts this in his Bible for a reason. He says, I see what's going on in Susa, in the citadel. I see what's going on with Xerxes. God sees Vashti and her beauty. God sees Xerxes and his banquets. He sees Vashti's refusal. He sees Xerxes' rage. And he sees the motives behind Xerxes' request for Vashti to come before him and his guests. We might guess at them, but God sees them. And he sees the agenda of Memucan and the nobles. And he sees all of this. And he's directing it. And he's ordaining it. And he's permitting it. And over all things, he works out his sovereign plan for the good of those he has chosen, for the good of those who love him. I think that's why Esther 1's in the Bible. Not just to tell us about what God's going to do, but to help us to see that God sees. You see, we're limited. Whilst we are watching on, reading the events that are taking place in the palace, in this second banquet, God sees Esther. And he sees Mordecai. And he sees the other Jews that are spread throughout this great empire. And God is able to not just do one thing, but God is able to work all things for the good of his people. And we struggle with that because we are so limited. I guess most of us, I've tried to play chess at some time. I've had that thing of trying to think not just about that next move, but trying to think, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 steps ahead. God is the master chess player who sees every piece of the board and is working everything out for the good of those who love him. So when we feel as though God does not see, we need to come to Esther 1 and say, look, God does. God sees. And maybe Esther didn't know it at the time. Like I say, she'd barely even be a teenager. But God sees. And it may take years for God's plan to unfold. And we may or may not see how God has worked things out for our good in this lifetime. But God sees everything, every person, every action, every motive of the heart, every fear, every doubt. And he sees the things that are happening where we'd expect him to be looking. He sees church on a Sunday. He sees this big church of Kensington with what, over 100 of us gathered on a Sunday evening. But he sees the small churches too. He sees the church of 9 people I was preaching in a couple of weeks ago. And maybe we forget that some people, even when they're gathering in church, are asking that question, does God even see? And we take it for granted because we're part of this church. With so many people, with so many things going on. And God sees the little churches, but he sees outside of Sundays. He sees your workplace. He sees your school. He sees your family life. He sees it and knows it and is working in it all. And so as we gather this evening, I want to encourage us to remember that. It is good for us to hear about the work in Belgium. And it's good for us because it's going to fuel our prayers, because it is hard ground. Talk to Jeroen and Henny afterwards. Talk to Hannah about the gospel work in Belgium. And then pray. Pray that people, as they, in their lives, in the hardness of a small church in Belgium, would know God sees. And God works. and know that in your circumstances, God is at work for your good. Whether you see it or whether you don't, whether it feels like it or whether it feels that it couldn't possibly be doing anything, God sees and God is at work. The second thing that we see in Esther 1 is that we have a need of and have a better king than Xerxes. As the author of Esther opens up this account and focuses on Xerxes, he deliberately sets Xerxes up as a godlike character through what he chooses to tell us. He starts off with this description of Xerxes' empire. Okay, this might be factual. There might be 127 provinces that Xerxes was ruling and reigning over. But ultimately, the ultimate ruler and reigner is God. His empire is great. And he throws banquets for people. He opens wide the doors and invites people in to see his glory and his majesty. He invites the rich and the poor, all peoples. And his garden, these gardens with the hangings that he describes for the second banquet. The descriptions that he uses are reminders of the language that the Bible uses to describe the tabernacle and the temple. These twisted, multicolored linens. These golden rings. The gold goblets that people are drinking from. Go back to Exodus and see the descriptions of the tabernacle. And the author of Exodus is deliberately saying to us, oh, Xerxes is kind of like God. In this chapter and throughout this book, the author is going to say, oh, Xerxes is kind of like God. This king. This great king. But what the Bible does is point us these pictures and says, well, he is a great king, but don't we want a better king? Don't we want a better king than Xerxes? For all his greatness, we also, even in one chapter, see a man who lacks self-control. A man who can't take the hit. A man who, does he love his wife? Or does he just want people to see that she belongs to him? Tell her to put on the crown. Let people see that she belongs to the king. A few weeks ago, we were looking at 2 Timothy chapter 3 in the mornings. All scripture is God breathed. And we can come to a chapter like Esther 1 and think, is this really useful? Is this really pointing us to Jesus? It's just a story about a king who's just a bit rotten. And yet, the author, ultimately God, wants us to read through this and communicate, hang on, don't we want a better king? Don't we want somebody better than Xerxes? God is not dull in his revelation of himself. He gives us the Bible in all its different shades and hues, all sort of different writings. He wants us to think. He gives us books which are written to help us to think rightly about who God is. And then he gives us laws which show us what God cares about and what God is passionate about. And he gives us poetry to help feel what God desires and what God loves. And he gives us history to see how God works. Our God is not dull. And so he comes to Esther 1, he paints this picture of another king. And it's designed to stir up in us this thing of, surely there must be somebody better and greater than Xerxes. And the answer of the Bible is yes. Yes, there is somebody greater than Xerxes, a king who rules over far more land than 127 provinces, a king who rules over the whole earth. A king through whom and by whom and for whom all things were made. There is a king who opens wide the doors to his banqueting hall and invites everybody to come and join him. Not just for a week, but for eternity. There is a king who treats his bride far greater than Xerxes treats Vashti. Who doesn't parade her so people think that he is great. Who doesn't abuse her. Treat her as a piece of meat. There is a king who loves his bride so much that he will die for her. There is a king of whom Isaiah 61 says, "The spirit of the sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and to release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair." There is a king who sees his people and sees his bride and loves them, even to death. How do we ultimately know that God is working out all things for our good? Because our king is greater than Xerxes. Because the emotion that we get is read Esther 1 and see Xerxes and see his failings and his flaws and his pride and his arrogance, as well as his majesty. Turns us to Jesus. And we know that God is working things out for our good, because there has been a darker day than the one that we're currently in. A darker day than one that we will ever go through. There was a day when it was so dark, the sun stopped shining in the middle of the day. When the king went to Calvary's Hill and was crucified for us. When the light of the world bore the sin of the world for us. But death could not keep him. Death could not hold him. And the third day God raised him to new life. We have a king who will rule and reign forever. Who will never betray. Who will never send away his bride. A king who will dress his bride in garments of praise, in robes of righteousness. Forever. And so we come to worship that king. That's why we gather week by week. To remind ourselves of the greater king, the greater story.